خمینی امام، خمینی امام، ای مجاهد، ای مظهر شرف، ای گذشته ز جان در ره هدف. چون نجات انسان شعار توست، مرگ در راه حق افتخار.
Our first speaker with us today is Imam Muhammad Al-Asi from Washington. Born in Grand Rapids, at the age of 11, he moved to Lebanon, where he finished high school and continued on to study the Arabic language at the Arab University of Beirut. In 1973, Imam Asi moved back to the U.S., where he received a degree in government and politics from the University of Maryland in 1979. In 1981, Imam Asi was elected as the Imam of the Islamic Center of Washington. 2 years later, in 1983, Imam Asi was unfortunately expelled from the center for preaching true views that were considered unacceptable by some of the higher-ups. Although the center has denied any affiliation with him, Imam Asi still conducts and gives khutbat al-jumu'ah and leads Friday prayer on the sidewalk in front of the jami' in protest to the injustice that was done to him. Currently, Imam Asi has been devoting most of his time to completing the first English tafsir of the Holy Quran, 17 volumes of which have been completed and 6 have already been published, and the publication is entitled The Ascendant Quran. And with that, please welcome Imam Asi to the podium with a loud salawat ala Muhammad wa Ali Muhammad.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله والصلاة والسلام على رسول الله وعلى آله ومن اهتدى بهداه
اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد.
As is customary, I'd like to begin by thanking everyone who participated and is participating in making this commemoration or this memorial possible. And that doesn't exclude anyone. So that saves us the details of qualifying who we mean. Secondly, I'd like to express a deep felt sympathy with those who are conscious of this occasion, that we are here to recall the epic days of Al-Imam Al-Khumayni. May Allah rest his soul in eternal peace. And as life has it, many times many people get distracted, and the tendency is with some individuals to diminish the memory of this outstanding individual. There's many ways, I've given this a thought, and there's many ways to recall the many events that were packed into the years of Islamic self-determination by the late Imam, rahmatullahi alayh. And so obviously within a limited time frame, there's going to be some areas of information that are going to be left out, either because they are so commonsensical that an average person should be able to fill in the blanks. Just in case those blanks are not filled in, we understand that this presentation is going to be followed by a Q&A, by questions and answers. So please feel encouraged if you do generate a question because of what you perceive may have been a lack of information on my behalf, then we are more than willing to fill you in as much as we can. The other gap, as some people may perceive it, in the presentation, may be due to the construct of inaccurate information. You know, in the years of Imam al-Khomeini, there was a barrage, and still is, even after he has passed away now, since 1989, we're talking about 24 years, there's been an organized presentation of information that deliberately tend to spin or skew the facts. So I'm not living in everyone's internal mind, and I don't know how that process ends up with each individual, but just in case that is the case, once again, I remind you that there's going to follow this presentation a question-answer session, and please feel free if you think the information that you have stands the test of time and is more accurate than what you heard, then you are also encouraged to come forth and express yourself. I was sort of given a, I don't mean to criticize anyone, but just for clearing the air, I was given something like a guideline, because as I said, there's so many things can be said about the teeming results of the lifetime of the Imam. So obviously we're going to have to narrow the focus into some areas. So along those lines, the issues were to more or less highlight the perception of the Imam concerning the Muslims of the world or the human condition in a larger context. And then the issue of sectarianism, as it is being, in a very bloody way, playing itself out in different geographical areas of Muslim territories here and there. So that was meant to be more or less something like focus points in this presentation. I will begin by approaching this matter, not in a very strict historical recount of events that is left up to textbooks and other reliable sources of information that you may want to refer to. But in today's world, I like many times, and I do this almost religiously, concerning the lifetime of the Prophet, the last Prophet of Allah, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon him and his, trying to approximate the human developments of those times with our own lifetime, because this is what, in the final analysis, makes a lot of sense. It's not enough just to speak about history disconnected from current affairs, and likewise, it's not enough to speak about current affairs without understanding the historical precedents. So, that being said, you know, in today's world, there is, as you know, I hope many of you are following current affairs and what's happening in the world. There's a lot of talk about what some information outlets call the Arab Spring or the Islamic Awakening. It's a lot of developments in that area, especially what is happening in Syria. Now, I know some of you, and I've already experienced this, some of you have very substantial questions about what is the nature of the developments in Syria. This, obviously, I have to clear the air on this as much as I'd like to discourse in this area, but this is not the occasion. So, but nevertheless, there is in the air, whether you agree or disagree, whether you are thoroughly informed or informed in a shallow manner, there's a lot of talk about what's happening in certain Arab-speaking countries. And beyond that, if we want to widen our scope, it's not just certain countries like Tunisia and Egypt and Libya and Yemen and Syria and Bahrain and these other countries that are more or less headline news. There's also a worldwide movement. You take a look at the economic condition almost anywhere in the world, and you see that people are sort of fed up with the results of their governments. There is a dissatisfaction at the popular level with administrations and with policies that have wrecked people's lives. Unemployment rates are going up. Poverty is increasing. Resources are dwindling. Those who are making cutthroat profits are very few, and those who are on the bottom line, the bottom lung of the or rung of the social ladder, are exponentially growing. This is something that was referred to in quite a few speeches of an Imam al-Khomeini. He wasn't speaking about the exact details. He wasn't saying things are going to happen in Portugal the way that they are happening, going to happen in the United States the way they are happening, or in Spain, or in Italy, or in Ireland, or in Iceland, or, you know, these countries that are, Greece, these countries that are suffering from some type of economic suffocation. But what he did say in many of his speeches, he spoke about al-mustadafin. The future belongs to those who have been dispossessed. And the people who have been dispossessed right now are beginning to show up in quite admirable numbers. When you tune in or when you read about these events in different parts of the world, the Occupy movement here in the United States, it began with Occupy Wall Street, and then before that there was the Tea Party thing. And both of these phenomena, they still exist. They're not as pronounced as they were in the past few years, but obviously they are still there. And they are there not alone, but they will generate more momentum because the policies of these hegemonic powers, their policies are beginning to appear bankrupt. Look, the United States here, we're all living in this society, we're not speaking about some other place that we're not familiar with. The people who are collecting food stamps have reached new levels, about 50 million. People who don't have insurance in this country. This is the most, supposedly, we are told, it's the most prosperous country in the world. And some will even go, those who believe in American exceptionalism, will even go to the extent to say that this is the most prosperous country in history. But what do you say when you have, what is the last census, 310 million Americans? Out of those 50 million who need food stamps, or the other name, there's another name for it now, to survive. Another number, 50 million that don't have health insurance. The unemployment rate, it got so scary that no one's mentioning the unemployment rate anymore. It was just before the American adventures, the American officials' adventures in Afghanistan and in Iraq, during the Clinton administration, it wobbled between 4 and 6% unemployment rate. Then comes Bush with his bushwhacked policies around the world, and the unemployment rate began to climb up to about 8%. Then comes Obama, and then the unemployment rate began to climb up to the teens. And that's when we don't hear about it anymore. No one speaks about unemployment in the United States. Why? What's wrong? There's a problem? You know, a country has a government has a problem when it's no longer capable of speaking the facts about its own society. Imam al-Khomeini, may Allah rest his soul in eternal peace, he spoke about the future belonging to people who are poor. I'll put it in simple language. People who are poor. People who don't have the necessities of everyday life. The future belongs to these people. And he didn't make any distinction about, you know, Muslims or non-Muslims or people living in certain geographical areas of the world and as opposed to other geographical areas. No. A blank statement. Al-Mustadafin. I think in one of his speeches he says that the future belongs to those who are barefooted. So this is what we're beginning to see. This fact has been camouflaged from our... one of the depth understanding of reality, of human life, of history, and of existence. When an imam comes out and he makes these bold statements, regardless of the facade that's out there, the projection of superpowers and what they call, you know, technological advances and breakthroughs in science and, you know, astronomy being what it is and nanotechnology being what it is. When you're plugged in to this type of information pool of information, then you listen to an imam speaking about the future belonging to the oppressed, and because you're influenced by the day-to-day bombardment of the greatness of certain superpowers, their military might, how they are exploring outer space and all of this, and you say, the future belongs to oppressed people. So, you know, this should give you a better understanding of the depth of what the imam was speaking about when he spoke about this type of future. There's been some backtracking by some individuals because in many, or I don't know, I don't want to become here sort of judgmental, but in some presentations, no one speaks about the condition of oppressed people in the world anymore, as if it's no longer in vogue to speak about people who are living at the survival level in the world. So some people say, let's take that out of our presentations. And therefore, those who have realized the discrepancy, and I hope and I think and I have a strong hunch that there's right now making up for lost time. Some followers of the Imam realized that in certain years in the past there was a gap that described the distance between the Imam and certain decision makers. So hopefully they can resume this fearless course that was pioneered by the Imam when he spoke about the oppressed peoples of the world. Another issue I think that doesn't readily come to the average person for the attention of the average person. And I want you to pay close attention to this. In the athar, in the prophetic tradition, fil athar al-nabawi, there is a statement that says, "Man abta'a bihi 'amaluh lam yusri' bihi nasabuh." For those who could not catch those meanings, the translation of that roughly goes like this. Whoever's actions or labor decelerate him or her, their affiliations are not going to accelerate him or her. Let me break that down a little further. If a person's performance in life is not up to par, progressive, fruitful, productive, if what you do in life is not productive, then you can't make up for that by your affiliations. You can't say that, oh, because I'm a Muslim, that will compensate me for not being as productive as I should be. من أبطأ به عمله لم يسرع به نسبه. Now, nasab, for those who speak Arabic, it is generally understood to mean bloodline. Someone's nasab is his or her relatives. But that's not necessarily the case. It could be any other affiliation. The reason why this took on a preponderant definition of relativehood is because this relationship of blood affiliation was part of that society. It was a tribal society. It was a clannish society. So that's what affiliation meant. The person would identify him or herself pertaining or vis-a-vis their larger family context. But if that goes away and there's other affiliations, you can affiliate yourself to an ideology, you can affiliate yourself with a religion or with a denomination or whatever. But whatever you think and however you identify yourself with whatever affiliation, that is not going to constitute for hard work. من أبطأ به عمله لم يسرع به نسبه. Therefore, if you, whoever you are, and however you define yourself, if you're not productive, if there's no عمل صالح, الذين آمنوا وعملوا الصالحات. If there's no عمل صالح, nothing is going to substitute for that. Even your affiliation. If you say you're a Muslim, but you are fruitless, you have nothing to offer. And then to take it a step further, as far as affiliation is concerned, because right now, and I'm going to shift to this in the latter part of this presentation, your sectarian affiliation, whatever you think that is, that's not going to substitute for the work that is required in your obligations to Allah and His Prophet. This is very important because in the time of the Imam, look, you know, we live, most of us, I'm not speaking about the very younger generation here, I see some here who are in their teens and little more, little less than that. But for us who have lived those groundbreaking years of the Imam's life. He never, I don't know, and as I said at the beginning, if my presentation to you is lacking in analysis, you're free to correct me. But from the best of my knowledge, and I live this, I say this in a humble and in a meek sense, I never sensed that an Imam, may Allah bless him and have him dwell in Allah's mercy and in heavenly company. He never said, I'm a Shi'i Muslim. In a public manner, or, of course, everyone understands, everyone knows. Who in the world, friend or enemy, doesn't know that Imam al-Khumayni is a Shi'i Muslim? Who doesn't know that? Everyone knows it. And he never said it. And when he never said it, but he was involved in what is called al-amal as-salih, in productive, in progressive, and in fruitful, bearing labor. The decisions that he made, the ijtihad that he was responsible for, all of this made people curious. Who is this person? It made Muslims curious. It made non-Muslims curious. Who is he? We want to know more about him. Now, compare that to some, I don't want to, you know, name individuals. Compare that to some people who want to place their affiliation before the results of their efforts or their deeds. Then people lose interest. They really don't want to know who you are. But when you don't, this is a very important point, when you don't disclose who you are, in other words, your actions speak louder than your words, when that is the case, you pierce their curiosity. Then they want to know who you are. It just happens, we learn from our own selves, it just happens that some people, after the Imam passed away, they put the cart before the horse. They began to make a big deal about their affiliations. Meanwhile, that edge that was there with action preceding words was lost. So this is an area, I think, that many Muslims, even the most committed and the most devout, could not discern in the life of the Imam. And that's why we had, and we still have, in the world, many peoples who are curious, because they look at, you know, look at the Islamic Republic. This is the legacy of Imam al-Khumayni, one of his legacies. Islamic Republic, when it is working on developing its own potential, then it captures the attention of the powers that be in the world. What are they doing? That attention would not be there if this amal salih, if this required effort was absent. Let's say there wasn't a pursuit of peaceful nuclear technology by the scientists of the Islamic Republic in Iran. They weren't concerned with this. Who's going to be concerned with their affiliations? Not many people are going to be concerned. But when they see among all the Muslims in the world, there's a particular group of Muslims who are breaking, pioneering new areas, breaking new grounds independently with their own sovereignty, without a hegemon to dictate to them, they say, what is it with these people? They're not like the Saudis. They're not like the Arabians. They're not like these other Muslims. There's something going on here. So then they want to study who you are. Then they are interested, what makes this person who is a Shi'i, what makes him stand out? It's not people who are going, you know, to certain occasions and massaging their Shi'i egos that make other people, whether they are Muslims or non-Muslims, make them curious about who are you? They're so curious, these people, and you know who I'm talking about, they're so curious that they have some scholars who are quote-unquote Shi'is who have come to American universities to actually teach certain classes in certain departments around the country about what this Shi'ism is all about. Now you notice this wasn't the case during the time of the Imam. There was no scholars coming to the United States to teach certain classes about what Shi'is are. Because the Imam was teaching the world what Shi'is are without saying, look, we are Shi'is. This, I don't know if you're catching what I'm trying to say. To some people this may sound too subtle to understand, but it's too important to go unnoticed. Because what has transformed in some of these years in the past was a fudging of this issue. It's very important to know that Imam al-Khomeini defined himself not by the rhetoric of tradition, but by the hard work that comes out of his commitment. Okay, I hope, you know, most of us absorb that point. Now we sort of move on to another area. And that area is that an Imam understood the Muslims among the oppressed peoples of the world, because most of the Muslims themselves are oppressed people. When you erase the elitist upper classes in Muslim societies that are what? The 2%, the 1%, remember 99% and the 1%? When you take away that 1%, the Muslim elites in the Muslim world, you end up with mustadhafin. Who are the Muslims? Look at the Muslims in the Indian subcontinent, look at the Muslims in Africa, look at the Muslims in even the Muslims in Europe. Wherever you look at them, the mustadhafin. So how did you look at the Muslim condition? You look at the Muslim condition as symbiotic. Muslims, they reinforce each other. And this is validation of the Prophet's hadith. Al-Muslimu lil-Muslim kal-bunyani yashuddu ba'duhu ba'da. A Muslim vis-a-vis another Muslim is like a structure. It's like a construct, a building. One part of it reinforces the other part. You don't build something and there's tension in the building structure itself. You build something that one piece of it gives more support to the other piece. Al-Muslimu lil-Muslim kal-bunyani yashuddu ba'duhu ba'da. And that basically defined how an Imam looked at the condition of Muslims in the world. But then we look around and we see, wait a minute here, I see Muslims in serious problems. Muslims are having serious problems. Okay, fine. Where do these problems come from? And if you want to trace these problems to their sources, they come from these elites. Our problems don't come from our pedestrian selves. They come from the elites. You can almost trace every problem to its power source or to its financial source. And this is what we are stuck with today. It becomes played out as an issue of sectarianism. This is what we are suffering from currently. We have a very serious problem of sectarianism. Why do we have this problem? One of the answers to that is that these elites are threatened by the average people. They see that these average people are breaking out of their shells. They were controlled, and they were managed to a certain extent. But now, with demonstrations, with a whiff of freedom or a breeze of free air flowing through the atmospherics of different societies, the elites feel threatened. And when they feel threatened, to get rid of the threat, they want Muslims to get involved in skirmishes, tension, and then civil strife with each other. So they deflect the danger off themselves, away from themselves. This is what's happening in today's world. Why is that? Well, al-Imam al-Khomeini and the followers of al-Imam al-Khomeini, i.e. al-Imam al-Khamenei, they've managed to scare the daylights out of the arrogant powers, the hegemons of the world. They scared the daylights out of them. Because what they see taking is one of the most definitive definitions of the Imam and his line is another statement or sentence that is no longer used. Khat al-Imam. What this line has done, Khat al-Imam has done, it has brought into focus a mass of people that extend from Central Asia to the Mediterranean Sea. We're talking about almost 200 million people. These 200 million people have, with all of the variances among them, you know, different languages, different madhahib, different ethnicities, different this, different. With all of this, one thing they have in common that none of them disagree upon, except right now for a smudging of sectarians. But the 99.99% of the rest, they agree that the Holy Land, Palestine, has to be liberated from Zionist occupation. Everyone agrees on this. So you think the Zionists are sleeping? Did anyone give the Zionists a sleeping pill and they can't notice what's going on? Of course they know what's going on. They're probably more aware of it than the average Muslim. So they're scared. The Zionists are living in a psychology of intensified fear. Intense fear. This is new to them. The Islamic Republic in Iran, the slowly emerging Islamic state of affairs in Iraq, with all the difficulties with the invasion and with everything that is meant to cripple this eventual conversion of Iraq, people and authority to an Islamic line, the Islamic resistance in Lebanon, you know, its virtual management of that country, and in Syria, here is where the issue begins to take a confrontational course. The Israelis have taken the pulse of Hezbollah. 2006, you remember the 33-day war in the summer of 2006, and they, to their surprise, found out that they could not break the back of the Islamic resistance in Lebanon. So they turned their guns on Hamas to the end of 2008, beginning of 2009, Operation Cast Iron, and they found out they could not break Hamas. These are two extensions of the Imam's policy to return Palestine to its rightful owners. The Israelis, via the Americans, they tried their best to work on Iraq, sectarianism in Iraq. Since the 2003 invasion and occupation of Iraq, they tried to have Sunnis and Shiites kill themselves until Iraq is debilitated. With all the sacrifices, and I don't want to underplay or I don't want to underestimate the misery and the tragedies that happened in that society, but the Israeli government and the, or let's call it the Israeli regime, and the regime in Washington could not have it their way. Iraq did not capitulate. Militarily, it was not bled the way they thought it would be. And then religiously, I know I've said this before and I got on some people's nerves, I hope I don't get on some of your nerves, but they tried also through religious institutions in Iraq, they tried to corner the Islamic revolution in Iran, and they didn't have it their way. So you look at this. One area was the military in Iraq, and it didn't happen. And the other one was the religious area in Iraq, and it didn't happen. And then they're watching Iraq very closely, and they see that it's being gradually absorbed into an Islamic orbit. So what is left? Hezbollah is out, Hamas is out, Iraq is out. All of this is in the Israeli brains, the countermeasures against al-Imam al-Khomeini, against the Islamic leadership in Iran, against the Islamic popular will in Iran, against the Islamic revolution and republic in Iran. So what's left? What's left is Syria. This is the continuation of what they called, Condoleezza Rice called, the New Middle East. Remember that? The New Middle East, in Bush's time, she was Secretary of State. She went hopping around Middle Eastern countries, came back and said, we're working on a New Middle East. They're still working on this New Middle East, even though the catastrophes in their foreign policy have cost the American people very dearly. You know, estimates of this war range between $2 and $6 trillion. The debt in the United States, for the first time now, the U.S. government is dealing with more debt than revenue. The U.S. makes every year, the U.S. government makes every year somewhere between $16 and $17 trillion. The U.S. debt as of last year has exceeded $17 trillion because of these policies. See, we're looking at a new world order. Remember the old world order, the Soviet Union and the Eastern Bloc and the United States and the world of democracy, etc. This is a new world order now. Brothers, sisters, wake up. We have to be ahead of the curve. This is a new world order. Right now we're looking at forces that are anti-Zionists and pro-Zionists. Pro-Islamic and anti-Islamic. This is the new world order. If you can't grasp, this is what the Imam was speaking about. People at that time, because there wasn't enough events and enough evidence for observers to say, well, this is the new world now that we are living in. Imam Khomeini was living in that new world the first day he stepped on the decision-making scene as the statesman and as the authority. This was, now it should be obvious. People couldn't see it 25, 30 years ago. You should be able to see it right now very clearly. And these people who feel, I mean, there's a type of, it's real fear. People who are in the wrong, they fear people who are innocent. This is funny. People who are doing the wrong things when they have all the power they have, they fear, they're scared. And the innocent person has nothing really. I mean, there's nothing much except determination. There's no fear there at all. Because people who are right and innocent, they have, whether they know it or not, they have Allah on their side. And this gives them the edge. I'll take this and give it a simple example. Away from politics, just some everyday occurrence that happens with some people every once and then. You know, this country is a racist country. Racism runs very deep. I think no one would argue that. And if two people were standing at an elevator in downtown somewhere, metropolitan city, you take your pick in the United States. One of them is a white person who is super rich, who is maybe in his 50s or 60s, and has this background of racism in him. And if you take a profile of this person, you'll find that, you know, he's a millionaire, he has arms, he has, you know, everything you want as far as physical power is concerned. And then next to him you have a young African person, maybe 20, 25 years old, who looks like, excuse my words, but I want to be blunt and I want you to understand, he looks like a bum. You know, he may have a t-shirt on, or he may, you know, scars on his skin, maybe not properly hygiened and all this. And he's standing right there, and there's only these two persons. And they step into this elevator, and they're going up to the 40th floor, both of them. Now, the poor person, the poor African person, he just feels normal. I mean, there's nothing in here. He's going up this elevator, and he has this white guy next to him that probably doesn't feel relaxed about the white guy there, but that's about it. Yeah, he doesn't feel intimidated. He doesn't, even though the guy there has all the money and all the resources and wherewithal and whatever you want to call defined power. But then this white guy, he feels scared in this elevator. Scared of what? He doesn't know this person, but because he's in the wrong, there's something, a residual in the conscience that tells him that there's a guilt that makes him scared of an innocent individual. He doesn't know who this person is, but there's a history here. Now, if you can take this little example, a very simple example from everyday life, and amplify that into the condition of oppressed people in the world and those who have military powers and have the resources and the riches and the wealth that defies imagination. This is the relationship between the two. There's a dynamic there. They feel threatened, even though they have. And this is today's real world. The Muslims are these mustadafs, just like that little African boy, that young teenager went into that elevator, and the other guy who has everything that you may define as power became phobic. He's scared to go up to the 40th floor, and there's this one person next to him. And this more or less tells us of the condition. So this is how they feel. This is how they feel towards Muslims, because they have, just like there's a history of racism in the United States, there's a history of imperialism and colonialism in the world. That's how they treated the peoples of the world. And so if they come next to them, they probably can't go through all of these details. They might not have enough but you don't need information. Your conscience tells you, and this is what their conscience is telling them, this is an Islamic giant has been born. In the Islamic Republic of Yemen, they saw this happen, they saw this is an Islamic colossal that is coming into existence, and they have to take all measures to protect themselves. And the most sensitive to this issue are the Zionists, more so, I think, than the imperialists, because you're behind a lot of this. The Zionists build to protect themselves. This is what they do. They go materialistic. They built a separation wall. You heard about the 400 or so miles of this wall they built between them and the Palestinians. I'm sure you heard of that. I'm not breaking any news for you. So they build the wall for what? They want to protect themselves. It's a physical, material wall, a barrier between them and the Palestinians. They say, okay, this is how we're going to protect ourselves. This is how deep their fear is. But they found that wall in and of itself, maybe it's protecting them from Palestinians, but it's not protecting them from these 200 million people that are coming together because of the Islamic leadership. It's not protecting them from... They're still unnerved by Hezbollah, by Islamic resistance, by the meetings and the conferences of Muslims that are coming together in the Islamic State. So what are they up to now? Right now they are building another wall, which some people may not be aware of, but this, just like they have this physical separation wall between them and the Palestinians, now they want to put a sectarian wall between the Muslims and themselves. So what do? In Syria, they are beginning this sectarian conflict so that they will be protected with a sectarian line. They see that there is a liberation line extending from Central Asia to the Mediterranean, from east to west. Now they want themselves, the American regime, the Zionist regime, and the Arabian regime in the Arabian Peninsula with its cousins in the Gulf, they want to build a sectarian wall that extends from the Arabian Peninsula to Anatolia to block or neutralize this coming. It's going to take a matter of time, but it eventually is going to coalesce, and the Israelis are going to, of course, they're going to keep trying to build walls, but this is yet another one of their attempts. And this could be another explanation. The ayah in I believe it's in Surah Al-Hashr, it says, "La yuqatilunakum illa min wara'i judur." There's another, "illa min wara'i jidar." "La yuqatilunakum illa min wara'i jidar." They only fight you from behind walls or from behind barriers. It's as if the description applies يقاتلونكم. This is in reference to you, the committed Muslims. So this, by them building these walls, whether it's a physical wall or it's a psychological wall, a physical barrier or a psychological barrier, they're still trying to fight us, hiding behind these barriers. This is to our credit. Because when they are doing this, we understand that we are doing the right thing. If they are fighting us from behind walls, like they were fighting the Prophet from behind walls, then we are in the position that the Prophet was in. This validates what we are doing. We are doing the right thing. But it takes just a little connection, you know, connect the dots or put the pieces of the puzzle together and you can see what's happening. When we look at this sectarian issue, we find that the Saudi Arabian regime is basically the instigator of this sectarianism in the Muslim world. I remember there was a time in the 1990s and for almost a decade after that when it wasn't very acceptable to cut down the Saudi Arabian regime to size. Some people would look askance. I don't know if this guy is saying the right political or diplomatic things. I don't know. I believe if a person is looking at the lifetime of Imam al-Khomeini, Qaddasallahu sirrah, would understand very clearly, evil is evil. And you can't remain silent about evil. These religious fanatics in Saudi Arabia have to be exposed. There's different ways of doing that. I hear some individuals who they throw the baby out with the bathwater in their attempt to expose the Saudi regime. They take a very wide strike against the rest of the Muslims, i.e. Sunni Muslims. That's not the way to go. Yeah, I have this notice here. All right. That's not the way to go. Saudi Arabia, the people, this Salafi thing, which has morphed into takfiri, a takfiri irrationality and raw hatred of the other Muslim. These people have to be approached with facts in a very methodical way. So, you know, just study them, look at them, listen to them for what they are, and then if you can, act as if you're a mirror. Place this mirror in front of their own faces and let them see how ugly they are. Yeah, of course, I'm presenting this in a metaphorical way, but I mean, let me say this. When you listen to these people, they never say, you know, in anyone who has a very rudimentary understanding of Islam understands that Islam gives itself to different sincere interpretations. The fuqaha of the Muslims had this thing in common. They used to say something like, رَأْيِ صَوَابٌ يَحْتَمِلُ الْخَطَأ وَرَأْيُ غَيْرِ خَطَأٌ يَحْتَمِلُ الصَّوَابِ. This is the type of integration and the type of symbiotic relationship that Muslims have with themselves. This saying goes something like this: my ijtihad, or my opinion, is the truth of the matter, but it may be wrong. Another mujtahid's opinion on this matter, who disagrees with me, is wrong, but it may be right. You get a sense here that, you know, there's room for accommodation. There's room for coexistence of differences of opinion. But these people, these takfiri types, you never, ever, and this, in their position, they are in violation of their own, you know, they take pride in attributing themselves to the ancestors. A salaf, it means ancestors. The predecessors, a salaf. Yet in how they talk, the way they present themselves, is in contradiction to the same salaf that they speak about. Because they don't speak like, they never say, you'll never hear any of them say, well, my opinion is the truth, but the other Muslims, and it may be wrong, and the other Muslims' opinion is wrong, but it may be the truth. They never say that. That what they say is absolutely, they're like, oh, astaghfirullah, they're almost like gods when it comes to opinions. What they say is the whole truth. If you agree with it, you're one of them. If you disagree with it, you're a kafir. Where did this come from? But this is what it takes. It takes people to go inside of their internal thoughts. I really even dislike placing the word thoughts with them, because they don't have thoughts. They just have notions and impressions. That's all they have. There's no thought there. But let's elevate them a little. I don't know. And say that they do have some rudimentary, some very elementary thoughts. You go inside these thoughts and you expose them for what they are saying. Say, look, listen to yourself. Look at what you are saying. You discredit Islam itself, the Prophet, the Quran, everything that you're supposed to stand for. And from here, when they apply this thing that they are the monopolizers of the truth, they have a monopoly on the truth, and whoever disagrees with them becomes halal ad-dam, means you can kill the other Muslim. The money, the wealth he has no longer belongs to him. He no longer can inherit. لا يورث ولا يرث. He can't receive an inheritance. He can't dispense an inheritance. لا يقبر في مقابر المسلمين. He's not to be buried in an Islamic cemetery. Those of you who come from Lebanon, you heard in this past week, one Muslim from South Lebanon, from Saida, died in Syria. Fighting against these Zionist imperialist financed and weapons supplied rebels. He comes back and he wants to be buried in an Islamic cemetery, and one of these individuals there, a so-called sheikh of this mentality, says, no, he's not going to be buried in an Islamic cemetery. So I had to look for another place, and they buried him in another cemetery. This is what happens. And it becomes ugly, because this guy, this fanatic who has this Salafi mentality, his mother is a Shiite. I think some of you Lebanese know who I'm speaking about in Saida, the big guy who's a big troublemaker over there. If you have questions about him, I mean his name or things like that, I'll answer that. But suffice it to say what I just said. And there's so much of integration among the Muslims. what made it impossible for the Zionist imperialist troublemakers to have it their way in Iraq is almost one third of Iraq is intermarried. Sunnis and Shiites married to each other. One third. You think about that. That's a quite a number to speak about. How are you going to bring that society apart? The same thing goes for Lebanon. One of the Speaker of Parliament in Lebanon, one of, you know, his daughter is married to a Sunni from Tarablus. Tarablus happens to be the base of Salafis in Lebanon. This becomes, I mean, this tears what the Saudis are trying. The Saudis are doing this because they know. Yeah, I know I'm running on. The Saudis know that this is a survival, a destiny issue. If they can't break this linkage of 200 million Muslims, if they can't break it in Syria, it's only a matter of time before they themselves are gone, because they can't deliver to the imperialists and the Zionists the division that they want among the Muslims to keep the Muslims in fighting. You know, the old policy of divide and conquer, or divide and rule, it's ancient, but it's current also. إِنَّ فِرْعَوْنَ عَلَى فِي الْأَرْضِ وَجَعَلَ أَهْلَهَا شِيَعًا يَسْتَضْعِفُ طَائِفَةً مِّنْهُمْ يُذَبِّحُ أَبْنَاءَهُمْ وَيَسْتَحْيِ نِسَاءَهُمْ إِنَّهُ كَانَ مِنَ الْمُفْسِدِينَ. And then right now, this ayah in Surah Al-Qasas, it exemplifies, it almost abbreviates Al-Imam Al-Khumayni, the Islamic Revolution, Wilayat Al-Faqih, وَنُرِيدُ أَنَّ مُنَّ عَلَى الَّذِينَ اسْتُضْعِفُوا فِي الْأَرْضِ وَنَجْعَلَهُمْ أَئِمَّةً وَنَجْعَلَهُمُ الْوَارِثِينَ وَنُمَكِّنَ لَهُمْ فِي الْأَرْضِ وَنُرِيَ فِرْعَوْنَ وَهَامَانَ وَجُنُودَهُمَا مِنْهُمْ مَا كَانُوا يَحْذَرُونَ. أقول قولي هذا وأستغفر الله لي ولكم، وصلى الله على محمد وآل محمد، والسلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. Thank you, brothers and sisters.